The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddhist truth one with myself. I'm going to be talking about perseverance, the great ocean of meditation, and asking for help. And for those of you who don't know, I've been a monk for 37 years. So I've had to persevere to make it this long. When people first come to the abbey or come to a temple or come to Buddhism, there can be a joy at finding something that makes sense, something that is real. It can feel like a coming home. It can be a relief to finally find what one has been looking for, what really resonates. And this was true when I first came here. I was pretty desperate, in a pretty desperate state, and really searching for something. And it was just a relief to find that there was something, that life wasn't meaningless. And in seeing River Master Jiyu, I knew that there was something else. And however, the path is not an easy one, as those of you who have been training for a long time know that. It takes a lot of hard work and perseverance to continue with the practice. When I look back at my life as a monk, since I found Buddhism, I see many twists and turns, great difficulties and seeming obstacles, and that at every dark corner something helped me. And I have to assume that this is true for everyone, that it can't just be me, although I can't get inside people's lives and know that for sure. I know that if you persevere and if you're open to help being given in whatever form it comes, that you will be able to get past any difficulty. However, you need to do the training and you need to accept whatever help it is that's offered. It may not be the help that you would hope for. In Roar of the Tigress, Volume 2, which is Reverend Master Jiyu Kennett's Dharma talks on Dogen's Shobogenzo, there is one chapter called The Great Ocean of Meditation. And it's translated as the meditative state that bears the seal of the ocean. And in this chapter of Master Jiyu says, all truth is at once reflected in this meditative state, just as all images are reflected in a quiet sea. It is therefore the highest form of insight. This meditative state that bears the seal of the ocean is the meditation of the Buddhas and ancestors. It's the Buddha nature itself. It's the unborn. Master Jiyu talks about how after realization you can look back and see where all the trickles of this great ocean have shown you what to do, have been present in your life. And when I was thinking of this talk, and it initially was just going to be asking for help, this section of the chapter came up for me. And I really like it, where it talks about the trickles of the great ocean always being present in your life. She also talks in this chapter about catalysts that lead to realization. And the section I'm going to read talks about that, but I'm mainly focused on the trickles of the ocean, so that you know that those trickles are with you. And this is Reverend Master Jiyu's section after a section from Dogen. Here he, Dogen, is referring to the various things that cause us to reach this state, the catalysts for realization, so to speak. If I were asked to say what was the one thing that caused more people to come to realization than any other, I would say it was the teaching of perceptual truth. We hear of all the koans and how stones hit bamboo, how somebody stubbed his toe, etc., etc. You hear all of this, but what was it that set the thing going in the first place so that suddenly something could act as a catalyst? There is a verse in the Shushogi which says, whenever these precepts are truly accepted, Buddhahood is reached. Well, we read that today. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven into enlightenment. That verse was the catalyst that projected me into the third Kensho. But what would have happened if I had not been studying the 10 precepts themselves in detail prior to that? The verse could not have been a catalyst. It would have had no meaning. What caused me to take up this detailed studying of the precepts at that point in my life? The fact that I was up to certain things, that something in me kept saying, you shouldn't do that. What was it in me that kept saying, you shouldn't do that, other than the trickle of the great ocean of meditation? Buddha begets Buddha in more ways than one. The catalyst is only a catalyst. It's a stone hitting a bamboo or a toe that gets stubbed. And this suddenly sort of jolts something off the shelf or lines up a bunch of poles in one line or whatever way you like to look at it. But it is that tiny little voice, that tiny little drop of the great ocean samadhi which gets the thing going. Through all the many twists and turns that enlightenment uses to find itself within our lives, these are, each and every one, its trickles. You know how on a muddy road out there, you sometimes see a tiny little trickle of water coming down. And just that tiny little spot is not dust or mud. And everything around it seems to dry up quickly. But yet that little trickle of water somehow still keeps running. That's how this is. Because we are honestly trying to train, a little trickle from the great ocean of meditation runs throughout one's life. By looking at it from the back end, as it were, after realization has taken place, you can see where the trickle has been. Anytime there is a trickle and you see the possibility of going deeper in your training, of taking meditation and the precepts more fully into yourself, go with it. Because this is what eventually creates a situation in which all conditions are ripe for a catalyst to do its work. It is going with the trickle that makes this happen. Do not go around looking for more and better catalysts. Any catalyst will do when all conditions are ripe. And Rev. Master Jiyu used to tell us a story of how at Sojiji, this, I think it was a Westerner, came there, and he was outside and on the grounds at Sojiji, and he kept throwing stones against bamboo. And I think Koho Zenji, we couldn't understand what was going on. You know, why is he doing this? But you can get that idea, that if this worked for someone, it would work for you. So there are two aspects of this section that I really like. And the first one is, through all the many twists and turns that enlightenment uses to find itself within our lives, these are, each and every one, its trickles. And I find that very reassuring, to know that enlightenment is actually trying to find itself within our lives. And it's not that we are searching for enlightenment only, but it's actually there trying to help us at all times. But it can only help us if we do the training, if we persevere through the difficulties, maybe through the arid times, and listen to and accept these trickles when they appear in our lives. And also to keep our hearts as open as we possibly can. And keep the door open to the possibility that our thoughts, our opinions, the way we see things may not be accurate. Because that's what allows us to see things as they truly are, if we keep that open just a bit. And then the other one was, that's how this is, because we are honestly trying to train. A little trickle from the great ocean of meditation runs throughout one's life. I find that very reassuring, too. And what is it that keeps one persevering and not giving up through the many twists and turns? It's the Buddha nature and our own longing to know our Buddha nature, to know our true self, the longing to know what is real, what is true, to be at peace, and somehow knowing that this is possible. And in Roar of the Tigress, Rev. Master Jiyu says, she's talking about the third position, which is the words that she used to describe this place of meditation within the great ocean, this place beyond the opposites. And she says, in that place, Buddha nature, the essence of Buddha, the vanishing that is nirvana, will be apparent as the third position. Now, there are many people who would say, well, two birds in the hand, i.e. life and death as we know them, are better than one in the bush, i.e. a third one of which we have no certain knowledge. And yet everyone has certain knowledge of the third position deep within them. And one of the things that this chapter tries to prove is that there is that certain knowledge. So you gotta believe it. In this chapter, Reverend Master Jiyu also talks about the unraveling of the knots of string, or the knots of self. And this is what I have seen my life as a monk to be, is the gradual, very gradual unraveling of these knots of string, and the ability to look back and seeing that some of the things that we believed in, some of the things that created our suffering, have dropped away. And this is kind of unraveling the string till there's no string left. And also, it's sometimes called the peeling of an onion, peeling of the skins of an onion. If you keep up the practice, eventually all the skins of the onion will be peeled away, and they'll be just Buddha nature. We hope. I mean, we know that, but we hope we'll be able to peel the whole onion. So again, I'll read from Roar of the Tigress. This great ocean of meditation can be found, according to Dogen, when our thoughts and things neither depend on each other nor stand against each other. When there is no opposition, our true nature emerges. When the obstacles dissolve, going beyond the obstacles and blockages, he is nirvana, says the scripture of great wisdom. When there are no oppositional blocks, one can speed along at great, great speed. This is what is meant by not allowing the arising of obstructing mountains and great rivers, or by having cut the roots of the past karma, which make it impossible to see across the river or around the corner. This is to unravel the endless twists and turns of the knot of string known as our life. Recently, when our abbot left, and I was struggling with what was arising, and I know that a lot of us struggled with that, and a lot of different things can arise. And for me, at one point, it was, why go on? And then I think the trickle of the great ocean showed itself to me. And I looked back, and I saw all the struggles of my life in training, and all the hard work I had done to get where I was. And I thought, I'm not giving that up, you know. I'm keeping on going here. So what I have found in, again, looking back at my life as a monk, that help is given in very different ways. And one time when I was thinking of leaving, the dog that I had here which was not my own dog, it was the temple dog whom I loved dearly, I thought, I can't leave him. So I stayed. So so there's, you know, if we're, but I'm sure it was more than that that was getting through, but that's what I saw on the surface. So I think, you know, it's continually helping us. I've been the kind of person that have asked for help many, many times over the years, particularly of Avalokiteshvara, great compassion. In my early years especially, I spent a lot of time in that Avalokiteshvara shrine asking for help. And it was comforting in the early years when I didn't seem to have a lot of faith, to trust that there was great compassion. And I remember one of my first questions to Reverend Master Jiyu when we had, we called a spiritual examination ceremony. It wasn't my first one, but it was one of the early ones, was about, you know, I don't have any faith. And she said, well, you know, why would you get up every morning and go sit in the meditation hall and twist yourself up like a pretzel? That's the word she used. So she was trying to tell me there was faith there, or I wouldn't keep up the practice. And some of you, I've told you about this dream I had many years ago about Avalokiteshvara, where I was in this very dark place. And at first I think I was having a meal with my family, and it was very dark. And then I was walking through a corridor. I left them, and I was walking through a corridor, and it was very dark and dismal, and on every side of the, and on both sides of the corridor, there were these horrible things happening. And I saw a door at the end of the corridor, and I was hoping I could get to that door. But suddenly, I was in this very light building, you know, with white walls and windows, and there was this very kind woman sitting there with me, and I said, how did I get here? And she said, you cried out for help. So, you know, we're given help. We're given help. And I think before I found Shasta Abbey, I was suffering deeply, and I was searching, searching in all different places. And I think, how did I get here? I cried out for help, and here I am. When I was a fairly new monk in 1975, again, I was having doubts and difficulties, which can happen as a newish monk, and not only as a newish monk, but sometimes more often. And I decided to leave, and I left for several months. And actually, as soon as I left, I knew that I wanted to come back. However, I had to stay away for a while to sort out the things that... some of the difficulties that I was having. And this little book saved my life, The Light of Asia. And this is the same book I had in 1975. And I had to laugh because it cost $1.25. New. It cost $1.25 new. And I just thought I'd read you. I still have what I underlined in those days. I underlined what was especially helpful for me, and I read this book every single day while I was away. And it kept my heart bright, and it kept up my faith. And so I'll read you some of the things, because it also ties in with this talk about asking for help and what it means. Pray not, the darkness will not brighten. Ask not from the silence, for it cannot speak. Vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers, sisters, seek. Not from the helpless gods by gift and hymns, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruit and cakes. Within yourself deliverance must be sought. Each man his prison makes. And I think in my early days when I was crying out for help all the time, I expected a miracle. I expected suddenly everything to lift and to be in a peaceful place with my karma suddenly disappeared and just being able to train easily. And of course, that never happened. And then looking back, and what was coming up when I was preparing this talk was what actually helped me at every dark corner was faith. Somehow faith came in one form or the other. Sometimes it was coming from someone else who offered me their faith. Sometimes it came from deep within. But it was faith that kept me going. And it's the faith to do the practice. Because we are the ones who have to do the practice in order to find the truth. It can't come with praying to gods, as I had hoped. So asking for help. I have found in recent years when I'm having a difficulty and I ask for help that there's what happens is there's just a slight shift in my perspective so that I can see things more in tune with reality than in tune with my own karma. And this shift allows me to sit with what's coming up to work with the difficulty. It doesn't make the difficulty go away, but it gives me the faith and the perspective that I need to go on, to handle something that I didn't think I could handle. I can see what I need to do, but then it's up to me to do it. And perhaps it's the asking for help that allows this shift to occur. And what allows us to persevere is accepting the help that is offered. Oh, I never read the rest of this. Well, ye are not bound. The soul of things is sweet. The heart of being is celestial rest. Stronger than woe is will. That which was good doth path to better best. So no matter how difficult the situation, if we use our will, we can keep on training through it. Unseen it helpeth ye with faithful hands. Unheard it speaketh stronger than the storm. Dear is the love I know of wife and child, pleasant the friends and pastimes of your years, fruitful of good life's gentle charities, false, though firm set, its fears. That was one that helped me a lot. Okay. Enter the path, there spring the healing streams, quenching all thirst, there bloom the immortal flowers, carpeting all the way with joy, there throng swiftest and sweetest hours. I did a talk recently on Kishtigarbha Bodhisattva, and I think this fits in with what I'm talking about today. Kishtigarbha Bodhisattva has vowed to stand at the gates of the hells, ready to help all beings find their way out of the hells. He carries a sintamani, or wish-fulfilling gem, in his left hand, which represents enlightenment, the liberated mind, the jewel of the Dharma, of the triple treasure. Its radiance illuminates the hells and calms the suffering of beings in the hells. What he is offering the beings in the hells is the Dharma, which is what can lead them out of the suffering, and showing them the brightness and the compassion that is possible to know. And this is what's important to know, is that there is a way out. that there is something besides what we think of as our, as life. And this is more for new people, because those of you who've been training for a while know that there's something more. But when I first came there, and what Kishti Garba is showing, is that there is something, there is a point to doing this practice. And Reverend Master showed me, she pointed the way, and in her I could see certainty, compassion, brightness, fearlessness, and joy. And that she pointed the way, and she showed me that there was something good in this practice, that there was a reason for it. And I think those both those things are important, to know what the practice is and also to know that there is compassion. And that's what Kishti Garba does. He doesn't just grab you out of hell and here you are now happy, but he shows you that there's a reason to come out of hell, and he shows you the way. And he shows you with his gentle face and his gentle words and his compassion. And I'm going to read the first three verses of In Praise of Kishti Garba, because I think this shows you what I'm talking about. When Kishti Garba walks resolutely with a ring staff in his right hand, he leads sentient beings away from the land of their misery and affliction, guiding them across trackless wastes, deserts, murky swamps, and through darkness. He delivers those with faith to the other shore, which is the cessation of suffering. If there are any beings who long for the tranquil abiding of nirvana, they should entrust themselves to Kishti Garba Bodhisattva. When beings die and fall into one of the eight hells as a result of their wicked deeds, they may at any time turn around and look in the direction of great Kishti Garba Bodhisattva. He then gives them reason to walk away from their endless preoccupation with suffering. With great kindness does he cure their ills by showing them the path to Buddhahood. If any being wishes to purify the mountain of his karma, he should entrust himself to Kishti Garba Bodhisattva. So you could change Kishti Garba to the Buddha. We should entrust ourselves to the Buddha. And this means that we don't dwell on our suffering, but we don't run away from it either. So we are willing to just be with the suffering until it passes. Just let it arise and let it pass. And don't run away from it, don't dwell on it, and entrust yourself to the Buddha. If you can stand yet one more. Yet one more reading. Although, says Buddha, the making one's in Although, says Dogen, the making one's inherent enlightenment manifest is a meritorious function of a Buddha or an ancestor, the various kinds of realization are not what make a Buddha or an ancestor what they are. What does make them what they are, the great ocean of meditation is the essence from which they and we come and go. So it's not a realization, it's continuing to train and live within the great ocean. Make the effort to live within the great ocean. The great ocean of meditation is the essence from which they and we come and go. It is the energy of which we are composed, as our appearance and disappearance, arising and vanishing, are but dreams. They are but phenomena in time as we think of it. They are nothing more than that. The real essence has no time. The great ocean just is, which is why it is in a state of meditation, and why it does not get upset by all our twists and turns and twiddles, and why it cannot be bound by the sorts of moral codes that we put upon ourselves. We cannot conceive of a moral code so high that it can encompass the entire universe and yet tolerate the twists and turns of each and every one of us. But that is just what the essence of the precepts, which is the essence of the great ocean of meditation, is. So, I hope that was of benefit in some way. So thank you all.